The following program is for entertainment and basic informational purposes only. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Cumulus Media, WPRV Radio, its management, or staff. This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Steve Bovay. Taking care of business and working overtime. With market insights and so much more, talk to Steve now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Steve Bovay.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Money Talk Show. This is AM 790, a station for talking business. A little holiday mix in here, a little night off, and feels like I haven't been here in a while. Although we've been here for about 25 years, those of you who are relatively new to the program, every night at 5 p.m., one of us on the team hosts the program here to take your calls and share thoughts with you on personal finance, estate planning, even accounting, if you like. A little bit about insurance as well. Pretty broad-based experience about myself, close to 40 years as a financial advisor, certified financial planner professional. All the hosts of the Money Talk Show carry that trademark, and all future hosts will as well. Wednesday night, as many of you do know, Nathan and I talk about history, what's going on in the world, and try to make things a little less nerdy. I tend to be charty, you know, in that way, and that's part of my trade, what I do for a living all these years. And so Wednesday night, we try to give a little more of a story to things. And we think hopefully that makes it interesting. And I think it does, Nate.
I agree. We always say that these stories hopefully give people perspective on what's going on in either today's markets or past or future. And tonight we're going to talk about, does the name Joseph Malacone Jr. ring a bell, Dad?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, so we're going to talk tonight about the savings and loans crisis, which happened in the United States. It was a phenomenon that happened nationwide, but it really hit home hard in the early 1990s here in Rhode Island with the credit union crisis, which was all centered around this infamous Joseph Malacone Jr.
Yes, he was later located hiding in the stands in the Tecmo Bowl game.
I didn't think anyone was going to know what the heck I was talking about, but you did it. Go ahead.
Yeah, Malacone was in the stands. He looked just like him. That heavy black mustache. It's okay. No. They don't have to understand what we're laughing about. It's a funny little video game that we had when he was young.
I was thinking about saying that.
And when that guy was missing and his face was on the news, there was a little character in the video game that looked like him. And so we used to say that's where he is. He's hiding in that video game. Anyway, we do remember that. That was a shaky time. An important lesson to be learned there, right? I have said for a long time, baby, nothing is guaranteed. In the purest sense, I always felt that way. Some things are more guaranteed than others. You know, I think the U.S. Treasury bill is pretty much a guaranteed thing, but is it impossible that something could go wrong and there could be an issue there? I think it could happen. Of course I think it could happen. I don't think it's likely to happen, but I think it could. So I don't know what the real definition is anymore. Pensions are faltering that were guaranteed. Social Security is supposedly guaranteed. Who knows what will happen there? So I think it's dangerous almost in a very odd, strange way, Nathan, to there actually can be more risk in seeking the guarantee because you tend to concentrate things all in one place.
I think it'd be irresponsible of an advisor to not look for the hole in any kind of guarantee.
You got to be suspicious.
I mean, even like you said, Treasury bills, yes, the odds of the United States Treasury defaulting is not good, but... what if it did, you know?
Right.
We have to consider that. We have to think about that.
We do.
Right?
Of course
it's our
we do.
Job, right?
That's right.
But you certainly don't put a high probability on that.
This is a little bit of an exaggeration, but over the years I've shared with my clients and trying to lighten things up because it's a tough topic that we deal with as well, is that when it comes to their money, you know, I don't trust anybody in a pure sense. I don't have any favorite relationships. I don't love this mutual fund company or any favorites like that. Those are all amateur mistakes in the financial business. No personal attachments to any investments or companies or sponsors or anything of that nature at all.
Yeah, it can be considered, I guess, a breach of fiduciary duty if you got all a client's money in one fund company. You could have 9 or 10 different mutual funds, but if they're all
it could be either
XYZ company,
an advantage to the advisor, that's not proper, or it could be as innocent as just laziness also. It can happen as well. And I think the smaller advisors, when they're getting going, it's okay to have things concentrated. But as you get larger and clients do, you need to broaden out.
Right.
I would think, you know. So I could see if you got audited and you were a brand new young advisor like your age,
yep.
and you only had 12 clients, they might all be with Fidelity. That wouldn't automatically be a bad sign,
right?
Because you were young and getting going. But if you had 440 and they're all in, I don't know if that's looks different.
Yeah, yeah.
You follow me? So,
right, right.
Anyway, this is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talking business. If you have a financial history story you'd like to either share with us, we'd love to hear from you, or drop us an idea and we can research it and come up with some, make a story out of a question or a particular event that you may find interesting. These events, we try to tailor them for people, maybe Nathan's agent up anyway, figuring that's the audience that listens mostly.
I find the older the people are, the more interested they are in history anyway. I mean, I'm kind of a weirdo, I think, in the sense that I'm in my mid-30s. And
I was interested around then, like you are.
I love reading about fiscal policy in the 1930s, you know. I mean,
well, you said to me when you were very young something about no need for fiction, to read fiction, because there's just so much else in real life going on.
I've
right?
always thought that, yeah. There's yeah. so much drama and
drama,
intrigue.
You name it.
In the real world, I don't know why you'd have to read something that was made up.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. I always kind of felt that way, too, but I never really talked to you about it.
But so the most of the history topics that we do are I tend to focus on my wheelhouse, as I say, are that emerging market period of the United States, which I love to read about. But tonight's topic, as I discussed earlier, more recent, something you lived through. So I'm really interested to hear your take on these things because you actually lived through this one
and had it.
And can give.
I was in an interesting position. Because Ms. Eileen Violet was very involved with that on a statewide level.
Oh, right.
And she was our partner at the time.
Right, right.
Involved with the radio with us and in our firm as well. We worked together with her on legal issues with clients, you know.
Yeah.
And it was quite a blow up. And, you know, I remember the the people in the bank CDs were angry because they didn't want these people bailed out. And they said they got a higher rate of return in some of these smaller institutions to right. take the higher risk. And I could have done the same thing and chose not to. So I have FDIC insurance, and I'm okay. And they felt that it was wrong for them, for the other group to be bailed out.
Yeah, actually, at the time in Rhode Island, or even today, actually, credit unions don't have FDIC insurance. They have something that's very similar, but it's not. NCUA, National Credit Union Association, or something like that.
We even have the ability now in brokerage accounts that we manage for clients if we wanted to hold cash temporarily.
Right.
We can park it in something that has FDIC coverage right, right. temporarily.
But I was going to say, at the time of the credit union crisis in the early 90s, credit unions in Rhode Island did not have what I was just talking about, the NCUA. They had a private insurer.
Okay.
And that was part of the reason that the debacle happened, and I'll get more into that.
Yeah. It's hard to understand or digest the idea that FDIC insurance, as an example, is just that. It's just an insurance policy.
If everyone went to the bank and tried to take their money out at the same time.
Forget it. No.
It's
probably a 10% claims rate. Above that, right. they're bankrupt.
Right.
The people who are insuring it run out of money. You know.
However, when you look at history, when FDIC was first implemented in the early 1930s, I mean, you had the savings loans crisis was the only time since then that we had serious banking panics and runs on banks. It never happened. We never had them in our country other than this isolated period since the FDIC insurance, since the New Deal and the Great Depression.
Mm.
Because before that, it happened all the time because banks were so local. You know, there were no large institutions. There were hundreds
of thousands. Risk was all concentrated local, too.
Right.
So the region did bad, the whole bank got whacked.
Right. It was easy for one bank to go under because it only had one branch.
Right.
You know, it didn't have all these other branches like Citizens or even Navigant Credit Union, right? They have a dozen different branches all over Rhode Island.
Mm. I would think even all over the country today would be a good idea because the West Coast could be a very different stage of the economic cycle. At times, and so it'll diversify your business a bit.
Yep.
This is Stephen and Nathan Bove on History Night on the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show on AM 790. Welcome to History Night on the program. We are talking about financial history primarily in an attempt to both make it interesting and educational as well. We're not big on predicting things. We're not procrastinators. I have a tough time with that word. As far as trying to predict things, but it doesn't mean that we don't want to study the past. And the way that I use the information of the past is to plan how to react correctly. not necessarily to jump in and out of markets or act like you're some genius that knows what's going to happen next, because that's surely not me. That's for sure. I've been saying that openly and happily for many, many years. Nathan, one of the first things that I was amazed by getting into this business almost 40 years ago was when I was right around your stage, 3 years, I started to be around other people who were very experienced. I noticed that nobody talked like that in the profession about market timing or anything like that. I thought that was something I heard a lot on the street before I got into the business.
Right. Yeah.
But the people in the field very rarely did you hear anybody talk like that.
Well, because they know the facts.
Exactly. They tried and failed at it enough, as I have done when I was younger, as far as trying to time things. I think if you have the bulk of your assets well diversified and you want to try to fool around a little bit with a nickel out of a dollar or something, I don't see anything terribly wrong with that.
There was a great publication we had in the office recently. I forget who did it, but it showed over the last 10 or 20 years, I think it was 10 years, the market gain in the S&P 500. And if you isolate the 15 or 20 largest days in the market.
Yes.
That made up most of the return for the 10-year period.
Right.
20 days.
Right. Yeah.
So if you had missed those 20 days, you would have had no gain for like 10 years.
Right.
So how in the hell do you time that? You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's a great thing. That's a great, great piece in history to look at to tell you that you can't, timing things is so difficult, you know.
And every now and then, I remember, I've been watching this stuff for 39 years, and every now and then I'll hear somebody, every 7 years or so we have a correction, and I'll hear someone who does get it right. Somebody gets vocal about it, and ends up being pretty accurate, And what the first thing I think of is, number one, I've been listening to this stuff for 39 years. I never heard them before. This is the first time I've ever heard this person's voice, and I never hear them 10 years later again either. My point is, even when occasionally someone does it, they can't do it again. It's an isolated thing that for some reason either you got lucky or some people just for some reason will never understand may have a little bit of an instinct for this sort of thing because they're really good at reading and listening and, who knows what.
Right, right.
You never know.
I think most of us in our field believe that the markets, especially large cap markets and so forth, are pretty efficient. And what we mean by efficient is that all the news that's out there is available and reflects
it's
baked into the price.
Right, right.
Now, when you get into smaller cap companies that are not, the news isn't reported as widely, there may be some more opportunity there for inefficiencies.
That's why you might want a manager on a small cap fund.
Where
we've leaned away from that kind of as an industry.
Right, we're talking about the active passive debate there, right? On a small cap fund, it might be more appropriate to have an active manager, but in my opinion, on a large cap value or growth fund, passive is the way to go, I think, in that respect.
Especially with value, I think.
And you look at the numbers over the last 10 years, it is the number of new investment going into passive vehicles in that specific space, talking about large
that
cap.
That space,
is really just really
expanding. I think it's the number one space where it's appropriate.
I think so, too. The other spaces where you don't see it as prevalent are things like high-yield bonds.
Right. That's why we have a closed-end fund. Holding.
Yep. And then the other one I saw was bank loans, also known as floating rate.
Right.
So a lot of the challenges in those funds is isolating companies that have a good track record here of credit ratings. Like we'll talk about bonds again, but they're improving. They're not AAA. They're not A. They're in the B's.
But they're improving.
So you've got to be able to do some research and track down these companies. You can't just blindly pick an index and go with it in those types of situations.
Right, right.
So the inflows of money for passive funds and those spaces, you don't see them as much as, say, a large cap.
That's one of the reasons why in our portfolios that we work with in our office, we are set up so that we can own anything. You can own a managed mutual fund for your small cap if you want to, an index for your S&P and an ETF for this and an individual stock next to it. You can own anything you like
in
most of these free market accounts that are available today. Now, that can be good or bad, right, son? Having 15 billion choices to invest in your money, is that automatically a good thing for everybody? I don't think it is.
Yeah, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, right?
It's tough.
Yeah.
It's really tough. It's why a lot of a lot of people in middle-sized corporations complain about the number of offerings in their 401k plan. But if you have a group of 300 or 400 people who are not that educated on the topic and you stick 97 choices in front of them, the administrative department is going to explode.
Right.
And they don't think of this.
Yeah, we set up a
They're not in the investment business, that company. They make fire trucks or something, So it's tough.
Yeah, we set up a simple IRA for a guy last year, and we did it on a fee basis. We're not handling the assets. We set it, everything up at some company.
Yeah, you don't need to be attached to it anyway.
Yeah, right. So we set it up, and I said, how's everything going? Want to follow up, make sure everything's going good. He said, yeah, everything's going great, except there are literally thousands of choices to invest in, and we really don't know what to, you know, a lot of the employees are coming to me going, hey, what do I pick here, you know?
Right.
And with the new way we set it up, there wasn't an advisor attached to the accounts to save them money. And with these new DOL rules, which I don't want to get into now, it makes it difficult for advisors to get involved.
Right.
So we basically had to boil it down and picked a couple of balance funds. You know, if you're in this age bracket, you know,
right,
look at these funds.
This is your comfort level.
Yeah. But I really like when they use the balance funds, that they use the ratio descriptions. Like,
yes,
let's say it's a 70-30 balance fund.
Gotcha.
Like 70% equity, 30% bonds.
I like that.
I don't like the balance funds that have the year target date.
I agree.
Because you don't know what's in it.
You don't know what's in it, and you don't, if you use it for a retirement account, for example, and you say, oh, I'm going to retire in 2025, so you choose that fund, that to me assumes you're taking all the money out that year and spending it.
Right.
That's where that's appropriate.
Right, which is not the case when you retire.
No, you're going to trickle that out over a long period of time.
Right.
I think one of those time-weighted funds is perfect for a goal like I'm going to buy a building.
Right, 5.9.
Lump sum, or college is all right, compacted into 4 years.
Right.
Cool, works there too, I think.
Yeah, right.
But other ways, maybe not. Yep. This is the Money Talk Show on AM 790, your station for talking business. 437-5000, 1-888-345-0790. Podcasts are the educational tool of the future. Check them out at 790business.com.
I do podcasts. I swear, I'm a junkie, podcast junkie.
Okay.
And if you like education, if you like getting smarter, I'm telling you, man, get out there in the podcast world, because you can learn about so many things.
Anything you want.
While you're working out, you're exercising.
Yeah.
You know, listen to it. Listen to it.
I had a little problem with a little outboard engine, a little red boat that we have. You know what I'm talking about.
Right.
And I had put my laptop in the garage in the back of the boat one time and played like a YouTube I found.
Oh yeah.
Of a guy tearing down the water pump.
Right.
And I couldn't figure it out, what the problem was, and I watched that movie a couple of times with my own engine apart in the garage, and I was able to figure it out.
It's a library in the palm of your hand.
It's unbelievable.
Right. It's what it is. It's a library in the palm of your hand.
It is. And think about how you can use that and how, I was going to say how inexpensive it is. I mean, it's basically free. You have to have the little tool, but how wonderful that just anyone can go and learn all these things. It is fantastic.
Yeah, any topic you want.
I don't think it's being utilized as nearly as well as it could be for education reasons.
No, you're right. And that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Even I listen to a lot of sports podcasts. And,
yeah, that's good, too. That's good too.
But, yeah,
I love the NFL replays, 8-minute replays. I watch it on NFL.com on my laptop sometimes on like a Monday night or something if I didn't catch all the games, you know. And, so that kind of stuff is really nice, I think, you know.
Convenience.
Technology of the future today. Wi-Fi to sci-fi, is that what we said?
Hi-fi
to Wi-Fi, yeah. Because in my day, we called it a hi-fi. For those of you who are anywhere near my age, I'm 59. I was just talking and laughing with Nathan that I have I still have my Kenwood receiver from my first stereo that I bought when I was like 16, 17 years old. And that was a hi-fi back then, and now everything's Wi-Fi. So hi-fi to Wi-Fi. It's changed a lot. The prices came way down, technology, as I mentioned, tends to be a late stage thing in our economy. So when you hear, like now, that tech stocks have been leading the way, really been up front, that's usually what happens, in my opinion, late in the cycle.
They are.
Yeah, and they've been out front for a while now. That makes them, I think, dangerous to speculate on, Nathan, right now. I think the returns have been very good, and to jump on them now when they've already been up is look at a chart. You almost never want to buy into a stock when the chart looks like a wave and you're buying at the top of a wave and you don't see it looking at data. You don't see the risk looking at data. I think you see the risk clearly looking at charts.
Right.
And when gold prices peaked, that was the best example of it. I think I told you I used to carry around a chart of the price of gold, and I'd go out to a lounge or something for a dinner or a drink, and I'd meet people, and everyone would say, hey, what do you think about gold, Steve? And I would just hold that chart up, and every time they'd say, thank you so much. And I didn't have to say a word. Just show them the chart of what the price had already done. And they went from can't wait to buy it to would never buy it.
Someone once told me that a chart was misleading. It had that wave picture. You know, yeah. Oh, this chart is misleading for this investment.
Oh, really? Oh,
I
really?
Said, what? It's not misleading. It's just a chart.
It's just a chart.
It's just data. I didn't say anything.
Well, I didn't tell him what he wanted to say, something like that. I guess that's what it sounds like, you know?
You know, I mean, it's, unless you have some kind of commentary with the chart, it's not misleading. You can interpret the data any way you want.
Any way you want, right? And nothing is infallible, but I do believe that if you use your eyes more than your ears when it comes to making investment decisions, that's a good thing. Because our ears are audio, and what gets caught up in our ears, along with information, is a lot of sales pitches in the world. Like every commercial you hear on television and stuff like that, so or radio, a lot of them can be very, not necessarily against the law or anything, but they're jaded in a marketing manner, where charts are just data points, you know, boop, 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 and draw a line. I like that, no emotion. You know, and so charts. So if you're thinking of making an investment, especially something that is speculative or a little bit risky, try to find a chart of it. What would you recommend, Nate? Big Charts or what other sites?
Yahoo Finance. So many. If you got a smartphone, I mean, there's
you pull up a chart just about anywhere that you want to do that. Yeah, yeah. Hey, this is the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show, Wednesday evening financial history night. Professor Nathan is here to discuss history with us. Savings and loan crisis we're talking about.
That's what we're doing tonight. The savings and loans crisis, which is, depending on how you want to classify it, was a time period between the mid-80s to the mid-90s. And it involved the failure of just about half of the 3,200 savings and loans institutions in the United States. It also coincided with the collapse of the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation, which was born from the Federal Home Loan Bank of 1932. So a lot of these safety nets that were put in place during the FDR administration, part of the New Deal, were really put to the test during this period. Like I said in the last segment, there have been no banking panics in the United States after 1930. None.
That's a long
time. Until this time period. We're talking about mid-80s to mid-90s. But the Resolution Trust Corporation closed hundreds of insolvent SNLs, I call them SNLs for short, that provided funds to pay out insurance for depositors who were otherwise out of their money. Deregulation during the early 80s allowed many of the SNLs to operate at negative net worths. many scandals came out of the crisis, including the Keating Five. Remember that one? Does that sound familiar?
Yes, I do.
The Keating Five?
Yes, I do.
So there were five senators that were implicated in wrongdoing, and I don't think any of them were ever convicted or anything like that, but four of them were never elected after that, and one of them survived, and that one was John McCain, who's still kicking it around today.
Right.
That guy's 80. He's like 81 now, 80 years old. I worry about these senators getting up into like the 80s.
Yeah, you know what I mean, it's a lot of pressure.
I don't want to sound like I'm.
You don't want your grandpa doing that.
I don't want to sound like I'm like a discriminatory. You know,
people, I understand that. But yeah, I mean, that is an awful lot of pressure job for somebody that age, I would think.
Oh yeah.
And most people that age have been through some health challenges, you know. So I think it was just a kind comment. I agree with you.
Yeah.
My father's 85. I don't want him doing that.
I
love him.
I saw somewhere there was a mayor of a town that was elected this year, the oldest mayor in the history of the country. He was like 90.
Wow.
Now that's pushing it.
You got to believe anybody on extremes isn't best for that position.
I would think so.
Either you know, 14 years old is a little young, and I think 90 is a little bit old, so I don't know.
Well, you go back far enough, you got these young kings that were teenagers, right, ruling the land. But obviously the scandal that hit close to home, like we talked about, was Joseph Malacone Jr. and the Heritage Loan Corporation, which
TechMobile.
We'll talk about maybe a little later if we have time. But just to give you a background, what is a savings and loan institution? What makes that different from, say, a regular commercial bank? SNLs were originally referred to as thrift organization or building associations, and they originated in Britain, actually, in the late 18th century. And they were nonprofit cooperative organizations, and many offered homes, mortgages to working-class men and women. And the thrift leaders believed that they were part of a broader social reform. They'd be very offended if you said referred to them as a banker or lumped them into the same group of people that were running big banks and stuff like that. They were only primarily working with middle-class individuals and providing loans for mortgages exclusively.
Right, very wholesome, family stuff.
Yeah, maybe a small part of their portfolio also was maybe a business loan, but the vast majority of their portfolios were mortgages to middle-class
and
people.
And importantly, private portfolios. The money didn't, wasn't sold out then, so you had a lot of flexibility of what you could take on.
Yeah, right. But by the 20th century, the thrifts had become known as savings and loans institutions, and the SNLs really regained their prominence in America after the New Deal in the 1930s. With all the new safety nets that were put in place, and it really led to prosperous times for banks where they had been very volatile prior to that period. And then with the post-World War II baby boom, all the servicemen coming home, all these babies being born, what do you think happens? A lot of houses being built, right? Mm. The 1950s and 60s saw rapid, tremendous growth in home construction, home building, and it was all to house all these people that were being born in the baby boom. So that obviously led to a boom in the SNL industry because they were the primary sources of home mortgages back then. So you really started to see this industry take full flight in the 1950s and 1960s. But it was in the 1960s that we started to see little cracks in the foundation, maybe little problems brewing. Mm. And this became mostly because of inflation and higher interest rates. So in the 1960s, SNLs began aggressively raising rates to lure in deposits to be competitive, and we actually saw periodic rate wars between SNLs and even commercial banks, where they were really aggressively raising their rates to attract new deposits. It became so bad, actually, in 1966, Congress set limits on the savings rates for both SNLs and commercial banks. Now, you combine this with the other problem we were having at the time was this notion of stagflation. I'm not sure if you've heard this word before. It's one of my favorite economic terms, stagflation. And not because it's a cool word, which it is.
Yes.
But because it had to be invented, this word,
right,
to describe the economic situation that was going on,
right,
in the 1960s and 70s. The word stagflation comes from two words, stagnation, because we were stagnant in the economy, low,
right,
GDP growth, high unemployment,
right,
and inflation.
Right.
Prices were rising, which is counterintuitive.
Right.
Normally, when you have inflation, the economy is overheating. Employment is high.
Right.
GDP growth is high. But this was the opposite.
That's why this job will drive you insane, son.
Right. Yeah.
Because,
never seen that before.
Yeah, right. Only because nothing is really repetitive in an exact way.
Right. Yeah. One of the things about the job that amazed me the most when I first started was sitting next to you in client meetings and looking at me and saying,
nope.
Boy, I've never seen that before, Nate. You've been in the business 30 years.
38 years.
Yeah.
Man. Never saw it before.
Still never seen that one before.
First time, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. And every now and then you meet a person who gives you a different look on things, too. See, I never really heard that kind of twist on it before, you know.
Definitely one of the reasons I love the job is because it's just different every day.
It's a puzzle.
Yeah, it's definitely a puzzle. Yeah.
Every time. And it is very enjoyable, very challenging work. Those of you who might be interested in a career in the world of finance, I would encourage it.
Right.
I think medicine, healthcare, technology, and finance are three of the areas that there will almost always be work.
Right.
You know, I think those categories, they'll have their moments of contraction and expansion, and technology will bring down jobs in some way also across the board. But I do think those are the three best areas.
And grooming.
Yes.
You're going to be a barber. Everyone always going to need their haircut.
Yeah, yeah, huh? how about anything to do with the pet industry? That's an obsession today.
I can't believe the insurance now that you can get on pets.
Have you heard the commercials? They refer to the customer now as the pet parent.
No.
They're pet parents. The people with their pets, their dogs and cats, the pet parents. Yeah. You're not a pet guy like me, so your eyes are going back on you.
Right.
But I'm just saying, there's a high demand there. People love their pets.
Right.
My best buddy loves his dog. I mean, he loves his dog, and I'm like, hey, okay, it's a dog, you know? I'm like the guy in the TV commercial, hey, what's up, dog? You know, no big deal, you know, just
what's
a dog.
Up, dog?
He keeps telling me how smart his dog is. I said, what are you going to do, have him go to the market for you? You know, you're going to do your taxes? Who cares how smart your dog is? But anyway, I'm just saying there's another area where I think that is a good, if you love animals yourself, as most people do. I'm kind of a weird guy like that.
Right. There's opportunity.
Yeah, sure. Great. A great field to work in. I think people will always find a few bucks to take care of their pet.
Pets.com was one of the biggest.
It's not a car. It's an animal. They love it like a many times, just like a person.
Right. Yeah. Pets.com was one of the largest bubbles. During the dot-com bubble.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
One of the largest stocks.
How about a veterinarian? Not good job, a good career today?
I think most kids want to be veterinarians, I think.
At
right?
one point in the journey, yeah, right, I did for a little while, maybe. Yeah, yeah. Most of the time, I wanted to be a mechanic like my dad, and still do, as a matter of fact. A little part of me still enjoys that kind of thing a lot.
But instead, we're advisors, and we talk about things like stagflation.
Yes.
So this time period, like I said, where the rates were rising, But because there were regulations on these banks, they couldn't raise their rates. So investors' required rate of return was increasing because inflation was increasing. So investors were requiring a higher rate of return to keep pace with the cost of living.
Right.
But banks, these banks couldn't really raise their rates because of these regulations and caps that were put on in the late 1960s. Economic conditions also made it harder for people to qualify for loans, which limited revenue. Again, there was high unemployment at that time. So some of the responses to these complex economic conditions, SNLs began resorting to several innovations. One of them was the alternative mortgage instruments like interest-bearing checking accounts and adjustable mortgage rates, things like that. This allowed the industry to grow and acquire more profits, even though the actual number of SNLs were declining. So you saw the number of these institutions going down, but profits going up. And then in the late 1970s, we had a whole new wave of inflation and higher interest rates. And this is really where you started to see some serious problems start to arise. So in 1979, the Federal Reserve, which was led by Paul Volcker at the time, raised short-term interest rates. And this created what was known in the industry as an asset-liability mismatch. So what happened was the short-term cost of funding certain activities was higher than the returns on the portfolios for mortgage loans. So a large portion of their portfolios were fixed long-term mortgage rates, and this is how they were generating their income.
Right.
But the new costs of their savings accounts and stuff, the short-term rates were going up. So this is asset mismatch liability. Very complicated. We got a caller coming in?
Yes, we do.
Let's hear.
Can we do that? Yeah. Okay. Let's say hello to Jim in Pawtucket. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Steve and Nathan.
Hey.
Yeah, I was just wondering about when you turn 70 and you have to take your required distribution. Is that something that you have to figure out on your own and that type thing? Or does, like, the mutual funds you have it in, do they figure it out
yes.
for you? Or is that
yes.
something
you've
got to compute your own yourself?
No. Almost always the company that holds your IRA will have a service available to you to make that calculation. And what I recommend we do with our clients is they sign a form that says every year recalculate it for me and then send me what you got.
Oh, okay. So they do it for you. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
You put it on autopilot, and then you can always go in and take out more. And then every January you get a letter that says we've done the calculation again for you, and if you've chosen monthly withdrawals, here's your new monthly withdrawal for next year.
Yeah. I was just wondering how that works.
You know, the penalty for not taking out enough is 50%.
Oh, I'm aware. Yeah, I'm aware.
Yeah.
I hear you guys talk about it all
yeah,
the time.
So I'm very proud that the brokerage business years ago said, look, even though legally it's not our responsibility, and legally it isn't, the penalty and the pain is so big that the best thing to protect the customer is for us to make a service available. And I know our company doesn't charge anything for it. They'll withhold the taxes, send it to the IRS, do the calculation every year, and they don't charge you anything for that.
Sure, that's good.
Yeah, so check with the people who actually it's the trustee you need to talk to on the IRA account would handle that.
Okay, all right, thanks a lot.
Hey, you're welcome, Jim. Thanks for calling the Money Talk Show. We appreciate it. Pawtucket, Lincoln, Cumberland, Newport, where we've spoke to people all over the state in the last 25 years. The signal, when it's in the dark, is not as large, I'm pretty sure. Or is it larger?
I'm not sure.
A radio expert. Well, somebody will catch me in the hallway and straighten me out. I think it goes further in the dark. I heard that, something like that. And so the range does change, I think, from winter to summertime.
Got to be the number one question we get from clients, too, I would assume. Required minimum distributions.
It's a big one.
Because 50% of the amount you're supposed to take out, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That doesn't even include taxes.
I met a woman once that was 80, and I said to her, asked her about her withdrawals on her IRA account, and she said, what? And I just advised her to stop doing them and don't say a word about it. And I don't know whatever happened.
If
many
Uncle Sam
years
comes
ago.
Knocking, just play dumb.
The best answer is always, always, always the truth.
Yeah.
I'm 70. I'm not financially astute. I didn't realize it. Right. And I found that the IRS, today's IRS, if you deal with them in what's called arm's length, which means they feel like you're not trying to jam them, they're very flexible and reasonable. They're not like you heard about in the 30s and 40s, and people throwing kids in the street and stuff like that. They don't do stuff like that. Even if you're filing your tax return and you can't pay the tax bill, make sure you file always, right?
Right.
But I believe you can go on the IRS website and get a form that you can submit with it to apply for like a loan to get installment payments.
Yeah.
But don't avoid filing.
The penalty is much higher if you don't file.
If you don't file. And that's really fraud. You're not filing at all, right?
Well, I don't know if it's considered fraud technically, but It's higher. The penalty is much higher if you don't file. Whereas if you do file and don't pay.
Yeah, and what, like not filing, you think you're going to get away with that? Eventually, that's going to blow up on you, right? Okay. Hey, this is the Money Talk Show, and we'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Steve Bove, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
Welcome back to the Money Talk Show. Thank you for joining us for 25 years, five nights a week on 790 AM, your station for talk and business. Yes, it is a lot. Hey, the last time that P.E. ratios, meaning the prices or the valuations of the S&P 500, got to this level, I read some interesting research done by John Hancock's research department recently, and it seemed about right to me. And what it said was that historically, each time in the past that stock prices reached the level that they're at right now by P.E. ratio, the 10-year return of the S&P 500 going forward was about 5% per year. That makes sense. If the average date is, say, 9 long-term, and you measure it from different standpoints, if you're measuring it from a bottom of a market up the 10-year period, you're going to probably get an average of 14. If you're measuring from a peak down, you get opposite swings like that. But the average comes in like 8 to 10 in that range, you know. So I do think we should be expecting that type of number, 5% from stocks going forward. Now, do we hope we do better? Of course we do. Are we going to be positioned to do better if it does better? Yes, we will. But I think expectations are very, very important. Better to under-promise and over-deliver. That's the best service thing I ever heard in my life.
I love that one.
It's being honest. You know, under promise means be humble. You know, don't be shooting your mouth off like you can do everything in the world, unless you really can, I guess, right?
Right.
But better to over deliver, I would
right,
think. You know?
Right.
So stock prices expect. I like that number. I think 5%. I'd be happy to be wrong. 10 years from now, when it was 7 or 8 or 9, wonderful. I'll be happy. But I think it sounds about right to me.
So one of the people that were over delivering during the savings and loan crisis. were these smaller SS savings and loans institutions. And the reason was, by the early 1980s, it had gotten really bad in the savings and loans institutions, and they were really hamstrung. They felt like they weren't able to compete for depositors because, again, investors were demanding such a high rate of return because of the cost of living was so high at that time, and they needed some more flexibility. Well, they got their chance when Ronald Reagan was elected president, who was very pro-business and wanted to slash taxes and regulations, and that's what he did. So Congress passed two laws that deregulated the S&L industry, and they could now offer a wide array of savings products and loans, adjustable rate mortgages. They expanded their lending authority, reduced regulatory oversight. It was more lenient accounting rules to report financial conditions. It eliminated restrictions on the minimum number of stockholders as an SNL could have, so it could attract more capital that way. And the changes were intended to allow the SNLs to kind of grow out of their problems. But between 1982 and 1985, the SNL assets grew by 56%, and that's compared to 24% for commercial banks. So they had a big boom during that time period. And what always follows the big boom?
Yep,
yeah,
usually.
But the growth was tilted towards financially weaker institutions, which could only attract deposits by offering high rates, and which could only afford those rates by investing in high-yield, risky investments.
It's the chase.
Right. By 1990, we saw it here in Rhode Island, everything started to kind of fall apart. And while not part of the savings and loans crisis, many other banks failed. Between 1980 and 1994, more than 1,600 banks insured by FDIC were closed or received FDIC financial assistance. That was the most, again, that was really unheard of until that time period since FDIC was in place. And from 1986 to 1995, the number of federally insured savings and loans institutions in the United States declined from 3,200 to about 1,600. The federal government ultimately appropriated $105 billion to resolve the crisis. After banks repaid loans through various procedures, they were a net loss to taxpayers of approximately $124 billion by the end of 1999.
Huh.
But as we said,
as I recall, people got their principal back, but no interest during that suspension period.
I think what happened with a lot of people was they couldn't wait. Some people had to. If you waited long enough, you got all your money back.
Right.
But some
right.
people, I think, settled.
Maybe that money was there for a goal. It had to be taken out now.
Yeah, they settled and they got less than
got
what
less,
they had. But
right.
But they
instead of losing the whole thing, which was the.
But they wouldn't have. I mean,
you wouldn't go that far. I can't imagine.
No,
it going
no
that
one
far.
Lost all their money, but some people did lose some money because they settled early and wanted the money now.
Right.
I think is what happened.
Right.
But that's what happened in Rhode Island. I can't speak for other areas, but it was this guy Joseph Malacone Jr. who ran the Heritage Loan Investment Corporation up in Federal Hill. He was also the vice president of the insurer.
Conflict.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah.
So the Rhode Island Share and Deposit Indemnity Corporation, which was the insurer for all the Rhode Island credit unions in 1990, he was the vice president, and he was also the president of one of the clients of the insurance company. They paid out about $16 million to clients of that bank alone in Rhode Island, and Joseph Malacone Jr. disappeared in November of 1990 with some $13 million. And this is what and created panic in Rhode Island. You know, people said, okay, well, if that credit union is going to go under and the insurers can't pay them, then we're going to go get ours, you know. And,
right.
Bruce Sudlin. The elected governor in January of 1991. First day on the job, he ordered all 45 financial institutions insured by the insurance company to be closed.
Mm.
It blocked assets to more than $1 billion for 300,000 depositors. That's in Rhode Island. I'm not talking about the United States. That's Rhode Island.
Right.
Many of the closed institutions obtained FDIC insurance and reopened within a week, but some of them it took a lot longer than that. And the state formed the Depositors Economic Protection Corporation to sell off all the credit union assets. Sheldon Whitehouse was the head of that organization before he became a congressman. In June of 1993, the final payout came in Rhode Island. It returned $454 million to 38,000 depositors.
Wow.
Now, only a fraction of the credit union survived. Listen to this. Since the crisis, credit unions have fallen from 58 to 11. There were 58 different credit unions in Rhode Island in 1990. Today, there are only 11.
That wasn't cost-effective either, the 58.
No, of course not. Way too many.
Yeah,
way too many.
Not taking advantage of the
it was
volume.
A bubble. It was a bubble. The SNL has experienced tremendous growth at the end of the 80s because of the deregulation and all these other things. And, you know, like anything that has a bubble that goes up a lot really quick is going to come down really quick.
I'll tell you, in my 39 years, if you ask me, you know, what's the one thing that jumps out at you that you could share with others to try to help them with financial issues along the way? And it is that when anything is the buzz, look out. And I've just been I'm old enough now, I've been through, you know, 7 or 8 or 9 of these things. And,
right.
and I can recall now how crazy it was. When gold was at its top, I knew someone who should have known better. And they told me it was going to be $5,000 an ounce when it was $1,600.
Yeah, I'm hearing that about Bitcoin right now.
Yes. Yeah. And this knowledgeable person at the time laughed at me when I told him I sold $4.5 million of it at $1,700 an ounce, and that was 5 years ago. I never bought any of it back. I never went near it again, and it was the right thing to do.
Okay.
But my point was, it wasn't that it was any kind of smarts on my part. It was my – it's hard to describe. It was I see it in layers in society when we get through the cycle, and when people who should know better, people that are in my field actually, sound like customers – and that person I'm talking about was a fellow professional in the field. And when he was talking that way about the price of gold, I thought to myself, he sounds like the untrained customer to me. And he was a pretty sophisticated financial guy, and he was just dead wrong on that one.
It's different this time, right?
Well, it was kind of that talk. Yeah, it's different
right.
this time, $5,000 an ounce. I kept saying, I don't buy this for 1 minute. Every time I hear everybody's in on something, and it's infallible, and it's already going up like crazy, and it's going to keep on going up like crazy, my nature is to just head for the hills.
There are no exceptions to behavioral finance.
No, there aren't.
Well, that's my theory. You know, you could say all you want about – you could say this Bitcoin trend right now is this new technology is going to take over. I don't care what technology it is, but the right. behavioral finance part of it is not any different.
Make a note to do another show on just that, behavioral finance.
No, it's one of my favorite topics.
Me too, yeah. Me too. Hey, thank you again. Great job on
no
Financial History Night at the Money Talk Show. Tune in tomorrow night for Don Sowa right here on AM 790, your station, for Talking Business, and have a good, safe evening.